Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Late yesterday afternoon, the news broke that Penn National Gaming and the City of Columbus had reached an agreement that will permit the $400 million casino project to move forward on the city's west side. Joining us to talk about that agreement is Columbus City Attorney Rick Pfeiffer. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Thank you.
Also with us is Bob Tenenbaum of the Millenthal Group. Bob is the spokesman for Penn National Gaming. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having me on.
The deal demands that all lawsuits involving the casino be dropped. One of the lawsuits was filed by Dispatch Printing, which owns the Columbus Dispatch. A lawyer for Dispatch Printing, according to the Dispatch, has said that it won't drop the suit until after annexation. Could that become a sticking point, Rick?
Let me back up before I answer that question and put this in context of Central Ohio and a casino. If you'll recall, when the first casino issue was on the ballot, Central Ohio voted against having casinos in Ohio. So from the start, Central Ohio wasn't going to be too receptive to having casinos, which sets a little frosty tone to begin with for casinos coming in. After that first issue passed, and we were faced with the fact there would be a casino, many interest groups in Columbus said, we don't want it where you plan to put it, in our arena district. We want it someplace else. So that created, again, some tension between the parties, that is to say the interests of Columbus and the interests of the casino folks. So agreements were made to get another ballot issue. A clean ballot issue was agreed to by the General Assembly, put it before the people, and they overwhelmingly said, yes, we will accept the casino, but we want it out at the old Delphi site. So we start with the fact that we weren't exactly on friendly terms to start with. So when it became evident that there were continuing controversies, it became important to try to settle it. And in terms of settlement, it must be understood that the parties to this federal litigation were the Penn interest and the City of Columbus, not other interests which will have a play in here. What we accomplished yesterday was a settlement of the differences between the City of Columbus and the Penn people. It is understood by both of our parties that for this to reach an ultimate conclusion, several contingencies must be met. First, Columbus City Council must approve this, and that takes four votes, and we hope that on June 6th, after a thorough briefing, City Council gets itself to approve this. And the three county commissioners have to yet look at this and give their consent. The other two contingencies are that the lawsuits between the Dispatch interest and Penn must be settled, and the Penn's interest in property they purchase in the arena district must be sold to someone right at a price agreed to by the parties. So there is obviously a possibility that something could put a hitch in this, but at the moment we are moving in the right direction, and hopefully conditions continue such that all parties can see the wisdom of getting this thing moving forward to completion.
I guess I asked the question because the Dispatch Printing wasn't, I assume, was not in on the work that's been going on for the past few days. Bob, is it a concern that that could be a sticking point?
You know, Ann, we've sort of made a decision that we're not going to comment on that particular piece of it. I absolutely agree with Rick's description of how we got to this point. I think that the public understands now that the city and Penn National have, in the words of some Penn National officials, laid down the swords and picked up the shovels.
Mm-hmm.
I would be very surprised if anyone would try throw a monkey wrench into this process at this point.
One of the contingencies was that an unnamed buyer will purchase the Arena District Casino site for $11 million. Penn National Gaming purchased that site for $33 million. There's an $11 million guarantee. Does that mean Penn National eats the $22 million?
Basically, that is what it means, yes.
Rick, you're shaking your head?
Well, not I'd need to disagree with Bob a little bit.
I probably didn't say that well, and I'm going to let the council.
I guess there's a question of what it's actually worth now. Yeah,
well,
go ahead, Rick.
It's not completely accurate to say that they eat it, because if you look at the settlement agreement between the City of Columbus and Penn, the City of Columbus, if City Council agrees to this, again, I emphasize, City Council, the legislative authority, must approve this.
Mm-hmm.
It's intended that the city will cut a check for $15 million and give that to Penn for purposes that are for public purposes, road improvements, environmental cleanup, that side of things. So if in fact there are parties that can reach an agreeable sale of that property, and that's out of our control, that's out of the city's control, then that, and let's assume it's $11 million or somewhere in that area, mm-hmm. and you put it to the $15 million, you've got $26 million. So to a degree, Penn is saying, we're willing to take a loss, but not a complete loss. And the city says, as long as we can contribute to help for the economic revitalization of the Olley side, and it's not viewed as though we're building a casino, then the city's satisfied with that. And I want to make it clear our Mayor Coleman's perspective on this. This is not about helping Penn build a casino. This is about helping the economic revitalization of the West Side, which I also know Penn wants because that will help their business also.
Yeah, and I would absolutely agree with that. And I think where you can really see that in the agreement is the creation of this West Side Development Fund, which will be jointly sponsored by the city.
Is this the $2.5 million each?
It's $2.5 million each over 4 years. That money is going to be designated specifically for improvements to the West Side. It could be street improvements, job creation, working with minority organizations, working with community organizations. The only condition on it is that Penn National and the city agree on how that money is expended. I think if you talk to anybody on the West Side today, they will tell you that that's a very, very important piece of this provision for that part of town, which I believe everybody recognizes has been hit terribly hard by the economic downturn. So I think there's an enormous community benefit here.
As far as the $15 million that the city will give Penn National, Bob, is there any restrictions on how that money can be spent?
It's designated for something that has to be a legitimate public purpose. I think it specifies that it can be environmental cleanup. As you may know,
yes,
Penn National spent in excess of $20 million of its own money cleaning up that site, so my guess would be that some of it will go to reimburse Penn National for those cleanup costs. That was a significant brownfield site after it was abandoned by Delphi, and it has now been totally environmentally remediated. So, again, I think that's another enormous benefit to the community.
And let me just add that the city's perspective on that $15 million is the money will be given to Penn, but then Penn owes the city an obligation to demonstrate, to prove that, in fact, monies were spent for those public purposes, and I believe that Penn says they're going to be able to do that.
Well, building roads is a public.
That's absolutely correct.
Building and improving roads and sidewalks and that sort of thing, that's a public purpose. That's what you're, I mean, that's the sort of thing you're talking about.
Yes.
The state took away a couple million-plus dollars for the environmental cleanup. That's a done deal now, Bob?
It is. That was, incidentally, only a very small part of the cleanup mm-hmm. because under the Clean Ohio Act, you can only get reimbursement from the state for future environmental cleanup, not any work that's already been done. So that really turned into not much of an issue at all because Penn National had already gone ahead and cleaned up most of the site, and so a lot of it wasn't even eligible for Clean Ohio reimbursement.
In the gaming industry, well, first of all, how far behind are you from your original start date? And in the gaming industry, how much does that cost you as a company?
Because this was settled when it was, and because we knew when we made the switch to the when the voters approved making the switch to the Delphi site that there was a lot of environmental cleanup work that had to be done before you could start construction. The casino is technically still on its original schedule, and we're still looking at an opening, assuming no other problems get in the way, in late 2012. So for all intents and purposes, the casino project is still on time on its original timetable.
You know, a judge asked you all to go into these negotiations on Monday. Why does it take all this kind of litigation and all these lawyers' fees and all this kind of rigmarole to do this? You all sat down, I'm sure you didn't sleep a wink. Why did it take this? What was the turning point? The judge?
I think it's fair to say that the judge, Gregory Frost, was helpful to this process. When the city is looking at the possibility of losing a guaranteed future cash stream of at a minimum $10 million a year, losing that and being told by the judge not only will you lose that, but you got to give these guys sewer and water, that causes you to have a pause and think about what you want to do. And I think on the other hand, and I can't speak for Penn, but I may try here, they also look at it as saying, well, we might lose out here too. So the important thing for the city is this. Given the fact that we're going to have a casino, and given the fact that we think that whole area can be helped if it's built, we want it built. But critically, we want it built and annexed into Columbus. And the key for us, and I think, and again, I'm speaking for other parties, which I shouldn't, but I will, they also want this annexation. Now, we still have in front of us a couple of weeks to determine whether this agreement's going to hold up. June 6th is when council meets. Hopefully, council's majority will see the wisdom of this. Hopefully, the county commissioners will see the wisdom of this. And hopefully, the city and Penn can agree that the final words of the settlement should be as whatever we think it should be. Mm-hmm. Then we go back and see the judge on June the 10th. And if on June the 10th we said, Judge, we're still there, then the Penn says within 10 days, and Bob, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think this is correct. Within 10 days after that's finalized, Penn has told us they will file their annexation petitions. That's very important to other interests falling in line to help get this done.
Yeah, I think and maybe here I'm speaking for other parties, but my sense is that there was a push from the judge, but there was also a strong desire on all sides of this issue to get this done, to get the litigation dispensed with, and to get the project moving. I don't think there was ever a question of the city not wanting there to be a casino. I think the mayor said repeatedly that he understands that the voters statewide did approve it. Clearly, the voters in statewide and particularly in Franklin County approved the move of the casino to the West Side site. That issue passed in Franklin County by in excess of 80%,
right,
which is pretty astonishing. So I really believe that there was a desire on behalf of everybody involved to get this done. And I'm not a lawyer, so I can't tell you why it takes so long. But I will say this is a $400 million project. There are a lot of moving parts to it. There were a lot of small issues that needed to be worked out, and they needed to be worked out in detail. So I'm not surprised it took that long, and I think everybody involved is very happy that this settlement was reached. And Rick is absolutely correct that there are conditions and they have to be met. I can say from Penn National's viewpoint that everything Penn National agreed to is something they're eager to get done.
We have an email from Mark. He writes, if the case had gone forward and the city had lost, would the city have lost the leverage it has by controlling the provision of water and sewer services in Central Ohio? In other words, if the city has to provide water and sewer to anyone who asks, regardless of the development taking place, it would lose control over a major asset. Would it lose control over a major asset?
We wouldn't. Let me qualify what I was. We would not have the control that we would want to have, and it would be giving up something that's very important to us and our growth, and it possibly would have the effect of stopping Columbus's ability to grow in the future. That was something we could have risked. That was probably the worst-case scenario, and we didn't want to have to face that.
The property, Delphi, was not in the city before, but getting sewer and water services, right?
I think that's correct, yes.
And that wasn't a problem for Delphi, Rick or Bob.
I mean, my understanding is that historically it was not that property, going back to when it was Fisher Body in the 40s and 50s, mm-hmm. was not in the city but had city water and sewer services. But frankly, to my mind, all of those issues sort of went away last night. Yes, there was a lot of talk during this whole process. Some of it was reasonably acrimonious.
There's an oxymoron.
But I've been called a moron. I really think that, I mean, I got a very strong sense yesterday that everybody involved wants to move forward from here. Let's put this behind us, get this settlement finalized. We are already engaged in construction on the site. I think in the paper this morning or saw somewhere yesterday that that the head of the building trades indicated he had heard that 33% of the construction workers in this region are currently out of work.
Right.
We're looking at 3,500 construction jobs over the period of about 18 months on that site. The faster that this project moves, the more people are put to work. Those are the positives. Those are the reasons we think that the voters of Ohio approved this casino issue when it had rejected four previous attempts to authorize casinos in Ohio, and that's what we want to see happen.
Well, if the rain stops, construction season starts, everything gets going. Bob Tenenbaum, spokesman for Penn National Gaming, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann, very much for having us on.
And when we return, we'll talk about a deal in the city attorney's office and how they're using social media to nab graffiti vandals. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Hear All Sides with Ann Fisher, Fresh Air, On Point, and Talk of the Nation on 89.7 FM. Join us for news all day, every day on 89.7 or streaming at WOSU.org.
And this is 89.7 NPR News, 75 degrees with partly sunny skies in downtown Columbus. We could see there is a slight chance of a pop-up thunderstorm today, a high of 80 degrees. Showers and thunderstorms are more likely for tonight, a low of 66. And then showers and thunderstorms are likely for Thursday, and some of those storms could be severe, a high of 80 degrees. More rain Thursday night, a low of 60.
Support for 89.7 comes from Edible Columbus, a magazine devoted to culinary traditions, seasonal cooking, and the local food movement in our community. More information on the summer edition coming June 1st can be found at ediblecolumbus.com.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about yet another use for social media today, crime fighting. Last month, City Attorney Rick Pfeiffer's office started a Fugitive of the Week feature on Facebook and Twitter, and with tips from those venues, nabbed one of the city's top graffiti taggers, as they're known. Rick, tell us how the social media, what was the inspiration? I heard Bill Hedrick in your office was kind of behind this a little bit.
Well, what I will say will be dangerous. I'm 67 years old.
Doesn't look a day.
I grew up in public life when you had a dial phone and when you had to communicate individual phone calls by mail. 2004 comes along and Mark Zuckerberg brings us Facebook. 2006 comes along and we have Twitter. Within the office, there's this urge to try to do more things. I tend to take I don't want to say conservative, but I tend to be somewhat reserved in how I approach change. But I was finally convinced that, yeah, this is a tool the city can use. If you think about the eyes and ears that help law enforcement, you have the police officers in the street, their own eyes and ears, their radio. We also have something called Community Crime Patrol that Ellen Moore leads that I think is in about five neighborhoods and about has 20 or 25 people in the neighborhoods watching and seeing what's going on. Well, right now, if you are on Facebook or on our account, you become an eyes and ears for us to tell us what's going on out there. So if we communicate to you and say there's 5,000 of you, we communicate with what kind of expense? No postage, no paper. We tell you, here's what we're looking for. Can you help us? That's a remarkable force multiplier. So we decided to go with it. It seems to be working right off. But like anything, when some things seem too good to be true, oftentimes they're not true. But right now we're in the early stages of seeing how this works, and our early results are very beneficial. So our goal still is, in terms of the city attorney's office, in addition to being the lawyer for the government of Columbus, is to prosecute criminal misdemeanor offenses. And so this is a tool that's obviously helping us right now in some areas. We're looking at expanding it in some ways and moving forward.
One question I had was about public records. Depending on how people submit the information over Facebook, would that be a public record?
It is a public record. It's generated with public resources. When the public records law was initially written, it was written when we did things with hard copy. And this has become a troublesome thing, quite frankly, as lawyers attempt to advise clients about your email, about your voicemail. But this will be a public record. And so we have to work on whether or not we have a proper retention schedule for this. So that's a good question.
And also the anonymity issue. But with Facebook, you're not anonymous necessarily, or you're less anonymous. With Twitter, you can be pretty anonymous.
This is something that folks have to realize, and this is something we face when we tell neighbors we need your help. We're aware of the fact that if you're a victim of crime or concerned about something in your neighborhood and you step out and want to show up against somebody, you might face some retaliation. We're aware of that. So we want to caution everybody to say that if you want to come forward and help us, very likely people will know who you are. Now, I don't want to say that to discourage people from helping us, but if they want to remain anonymous, they're going to have to make sure that they do, because we don't want them to face retribution for assisting us in enforcing the law.
My guest is Rick Pfeiffer. He's a Columbus City attorney. If you have any questions or comments for him, we're talking about using social media to fight crime. In this case of the city attorney's office, it's misdemeanor crime. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also join the chat at wosu.org/allsides. And we're on Twitter, too. So if is when you're, you know, starting to follow the city attorney's office, that's on Twitter now, and Rick Pfeiffer is too, as a matter of fact. You can follow Fisher, WSU.
One of the things that I'm looking at this is to give the public an opportunity to instantaneously say, how are we doing out there as your public servant in the city attorney's office? Now, you know, if you think we're doing a lousy job, tell me why. If you think we're doing a good job, tell me why. I mean, you know, I only serve if I get elected. Now, I'm not going to get all the votes, but I certainly would like to get at least a majority of the votes. And I think my view of Central Ohio is that if a public official is doing a good job, he or she's going to stay in office. So I don't want to have a deaf ear or blind eye to somebody saying, Rick, in this area you need to improve. And I'll say, well, tell me why. And I'll say, you know, you're right. I'm failing in that area. Tell me. And those are things I look for. I don't want somebody to tell me what they think I want to hear. I want to hear from them what they really believe. Now, sometimes you get people that are just going to be unreasonable with you, that didn't get an answer they wanted when you know the law was what it should be. But I look forward to public comment about saying how they think we're doing. Because if we're not doing a good job in some area, I want us to do a good job in those areas.
And social media is a way to find out very quickly.
Well, absolutely. If you go to our website, columbuscityattorney.org, you're going to find the name of everybody that works for me. You're going to find their direct phone numbers, the direct emails. I don't know how many times they go to people's website. I can't find an individual. It's like info. But we are there. We don't hide from you if you know that all you got to do is go to our website. Oftentimes we'll have people complain about they didn't get a charge filed in our intake, or a victim realizing, well, why didn't she get a conviction? We might say, why? A police officer might not like a particular result. But we're there. You can talk to us. We want to hear from you. We don't want to hear back room. We don't want to hear backside. We want to hear directly from you. And there's no excuse based upon how we present ourselves to the public that you can contact us directly, any of us. Now, there is no filter on my people. That is to say, if any one of my persons get contacted by the press, they're free to talk to the press. Now, I'm assuming, of course, they'll be. Yes. If you, Ann Fisher, if you want to know how someone did something, you can go to our website and find someone's name. If you want to know how Bill Hedrick's operating, you of course.
Chief of staff, by the way.
He's welcomes all sorts of things. But again, I think social media, or at least, and I don't, we call it social media. And I think my viewing the movie was also instrumental into me realizing, oh my God, this can really be a force multiplier. We want to hear from people, and we want people to hear from us to let them know what we're doing.
You have fewer than 500 people liking your page right now. What are you shooting for? I mean, is there a goal here?
I do not know.
Okay. So how new is this?
For us?
Yeah.
Oh, it's been in the last month.
Okay, so it's very, very new.
This is very new for us. What I've tried to do repeatedly in the past is let people know about our website and encourage them to go there because they can find out what we do, and again, I know this is repetition. Everybody that works for me has their name on that website, their direct phone number, their direct email. And if you want to contact them, you can do it directly. And they're not permitted, they're not prohibited by me from saying, oh, Rick, can I call so-and-so back? Yes. Now, occasionally, frankly, we get some citizens that call us that are just totally unreasonable. And our experience with them says we're done talking with them. They might be abusive to us, or they might not have listened to the rationale we gave them. Those are a few instances.
How did it work when it came to catching this graffiti tagger? How exactly did it work? Did you post something on Facebook or Twitter, and then how did it work?
If I tell you all the secrets, we can't
tell as much as you can.
If I tell you all of our what did Mullane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, says, we got to stop talking about this. I think the one of the things to remember is that we had police officers that also liked this, that helped them facilitate what they were doing. And again, the citizens became an additional radar, an additional sensor device for our police officers to go find somebody. And that's basically the secret, if you will.
So they're getting into it too.
Yes. I think you will find that police officers that have worked with us early on like what happened. They were given information that came more quickly to them. And they acted on it. And the timeliness of information is important. If it's stale information, you know, I mean, when I was in Vietnam, they used to order in these B-52 strikes, and sometimes they were based on information that was given a week or two ago. But this kind of information, hey, we just got something this morning, check it out. That's not stale information. That's current, and that could most likely facilitate the apprehension of people who have warrants or we want to be brought into custody.
Do you worry about on your Facebook page for the office having one or multiple voices? That's something that, you know, we've kind of grappled with the All Sides Facebook pages. When people look at someone posting from our office on it, who's really talking? And what about that with you? Do you have multiple people have access to it, administrators of the Facebook page? And
I can't
voices?
Answer your question right now. I'm counting on people that work with me to educate me completely on what we're doing. I ask questions. If problems arise, I say, and it's important, identify the problem. What specifically is the problem? Okay, well, here are the answers. Here's how to solve that. But right now, we haven't confronted that. If we do, and we identify it as a problem, and we specifically define the contours of that problem, then we'll figure out how to resolve it.
Now, when you're talking about the graffiti issue, have you limited the social media, you know, apprehension to just graffiti, or is this something that's something that's out there that you could use for a lot of different crime-fighting purposes?
We intend to expand it.
What's next?
Well, this is something that I had been thinking about that I was told I shouldn't say. But if you go down to the courthouse, you're going to find thousands of warrants that are outstanding. And for whatever reasons, we're talking right now, frankly, about posting on our website something to say, do you or someone you know have a warrant for your arrest? Here's how you go find out. Right now, there's consideration to do a fugitive safe surrender program. This is one where a lot of folks who might at a younger age done something they wish they hadn't done, never held accountable to it, but they know there's a warrant for the arrest. But 10 years later, they're now righteous, but they can't get employed. So we're going to say, well, if you want, as long as it's not something like assaultive behavior, the victim's really been hurt. If it's a property offense or maybe a drug offense, a nonviolent. This whole idea of a fugitive safe surrender is to try to get folks to come in out of the cold and say, yeah, you do have this. In the past, you did this. You're going to have to be held accountable for you. But if it's holding up, you're becoming a productive citizen. We want to help with that. So we're trying to look at these back warrants and how we can reduce them. Even though people make mistakes in their life, and sometimes it's a mistake that's criminal, later on they come to regret it. And later on, they realize it inhibits their ability to become a productive citizen. So come on in if you're bold enough, if you're safe enough, and we'll take a look at it. But now, if it's for someone where you've shot somebody or you've raped somebody, you're not going to want to come in because we're going to be real strong with you. And those kind of things are outside my jurisdiction anyway. But if you look at things that are smaller. That are outstanding warrants for criminal conduct, but yet you're willing now to say, I did wrong, I want to get right, and I can become a productive member of society, but until I clean this up, I can't. Well, come on in. We'll talk with you about it.
During this economic downturn, where supposedly the recession, the Great Recession's over with, but we're feeling the ripple effects of it, of course, what are you noticing in terms of issues that are you're confronted with in your office that there's been a, you know, that maybe is related to the economy and you've seen an uptick in or a downtick in, I guess, suppose?
I can't tell you that looking at crime statistics, I can correlate to any economic condition. I can tell you that according to the economic situation, we don't have people leaving their jobs in our office, that there are not, in fact, for lawyers, if the market is very depressed for folks that have law degrees. But in terms of what the question you asked was, do I see any correlation between the economic status and the crime statistics, I can't right now. That's mm-hmm. not to say there isn't any, but I can't perceive what it might be.
The graffiti thing, some people think it's not that big of a deal and not that doesn't warrant this much attention. What does graffiti cost Columbus residents, I suppose, not the city per se, but city, if it's city property?
Graffiti is a big problem when it's in your neighborhood, when it degrades your neighborhood, when it takes away from the appearance of a safe neighborhood. I can't remember what the dollar costs are. There's significant dollar costs to the effect that graffiti has on the quality of life in neighborhoods. You say it's not assaultive. Once you graffiti a building, it stays there every day, and the frustration of the people that have to look at it, their anger grows. Council member Zach Klein had a hearing on graffiti, and you could see the legitimate frustration on the neighbors' parts that came to testify, and you could see that their anger was such that they wanted to increase the penalties. That's not the answer, I don't think, because we have to catch these folks first. And I think Councilmember Klein is working on trying to figure out how to do this. We've got to take this graffiti down to help the neighborhoods. But if anybody believes that it's not such a big deal, that tells me they don't have graffiti in their neighborhood, and where they travel, they don't see it.
Okay. That's Rick Pfeiffer. Rick Pfeiffer, our Columbus City Attorney, not Paul Pfeiffer, Rick Pfeiffer.
Two S versus two.
Yeah, I covered you when you both served in the Senate, so I passed that test. Thanks for joining us today, Rick.
Thank you, Ann.
When we return, we'll be talking about the Ohio's Consumers Council and the budget cuts facing her. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In The Hangover, Bradley Cooper worked with a tiger. In The Hangover Part 2, he works with a monkey who plays a cigarette-smoking drug dealer who occasionally panicked.
Crystal would just claw into my shoulder. I was, like, bleeding. I had scars, and we kept saying, she has her shots, right?
Bradley Cooper on the next Fresh Air, and John Powers talks about Cannes. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. There are many ways to get the latest local news. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or like WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. Just visit WOSU.org/email to sign up.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Central Ohio Trauma System, working with community partners to make Central Ohio a safer place to live. Details about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the Central Ohio Trauma System are at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
75 degrees currently in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies today and a few clouds, a high of 80 degrees. Showers and thunderstorms, maybe a pop-up thunderstorm tonight and a low of 66. And then showers and thunderstorms are likely off and on throughout the day on Thursday. Some of those storms could be severe, a high of 80 degrees. Another chance for showers and thunderstorms Thursday night and a low of 60. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The governor has proposed and the Ohio House has embraced cutting 51% of the office, 51% of the funding for the Office of the Ohio Consumers Council. The House amended the budget, now pending in the Senate, to include a gag order as well that would prevent the Consumers Council from taking a position against further deregulation of the natural gas market. We've invited many guests to represent those who endorse those cuts and those changes, but none have accepted our invitation. Joining us today to defend the office is Ohio's Consumers Council, Janine Migden Ostrander. Welcome to the show, Janine.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get started on the defense of the cuts and your response, can you tell us what the Consumers Council was intended for back in 1976 when it was established and why it's still relevant today?
Sure. Back in 1976, when the Office of the Consumers Council was established, it was felt that there was not enough consumer protection at the commission. The Public Utilities Commission of Ohio listens to the cases, and utilities would come in and they would file for dramatic increases in rates, one after the other after the other. And there was nobody representing the consumers, the customers of the state of Ohio, who pay the bills to say, this increase may be too much, this increase, this part of this increase may not be reasonable or rational, and we really need to take a close look and defend the customer interest in it. So it was from the standpoint of trying to control rate increases, which were having a dramatic impact on customers' wallets, not only residential but business and commercial. And it was also established to provide someone to speak up basically for the little guy on consumer protection issues, disconnection of service, deposits, and a whole host of other kinds of issues that impact customers and their ability to pay their bills.
Since deregulation, though, haven't things changed in terms of the rate increases and the representation of the consumer?
Actually, the number of cases that we intervene in now or that we have has increased dramatically as a result of deregulation because we don't really have a full deregulation. Electric companies still come in with what's called electric security plans, which are really glorified rate increases, and there's a whole host of issues that have to be dealt with in those cases. And even with deregulation of supply, you still have the distribution systems that are regulated. And for natural gas, you have gas distribution rate increases. And there's a whole host of activity around maintaining the competitive market to make sure that it is fair and it is providing good value to the public.
And there are other utilities like water.
Correct. We are involved in cases involving investor-owned utilities. We have no jurisdiction over municipal water systems, but the investor-owned utilities have been in for dramatic rate increases in some in the central Ohio area.
Water companies.
Correct.
Yeah.
Year after year that have been very significant and have really made it extremely difficult for local residents to afford water.
On April 21st, there were dueling columns, one by you and Janine Migden Ostrander, and one by Andrew Dorrell. He is the president of the Ohio Chamber of Commerce since 1993, and Andy couldn't be here today. And I thought we could kind of go through that and compare and contrast points of view on the issues that he raises in his column. He says that the Ohio Chamber He comments on the current proposal to reduce duplication and improve outcomes in the Office of the Ohio Consumers Council. He's referring to, of course, what's in the budget that they've said that the governor's office has said that it reduces duplication, that what they're already doing, what you do is already being done in the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio.
Well, we would disagree with that comment. You have to look at it from the standpoint that the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio is like the judge. The utilities come in and they file for rate increases, so then they defend their rate increases. We view our role as the Consumers Council as being really sort of on the side of the people, sort of like the prosecutor. We come in and we say, there's two sides to every story, you know, as you know by the name of your show, that
there's usually many sides.
Many sides, that's correct. And so we come in and we represent the residential customer interest in saying, you know, here's what the utility is proposing. We have our lawyers. We have our analytical staff of accountants, engineers, and economists who take a look at these highly complex, voluminous filings and make proposals for where the rate increase that they're requesting should be cut. and that saves more money for customers. If we're not there to do that, then what the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio will have is a slanted one-side record that shows the utility defending why they need all this money without the counter position of saying, here's where we can trim some of this increase.
Well, aren't there public comment periods where the public can weigh in, send letters to the Public Utilities Commission and complain about things, and won't that be entered into the record and be taken into consideration?
Sure, there is. There absolutely is. But the problem is that these issues are so highly technical and complex. What a citizen typically will do will be to write a letter and saying, here's the impact of this rate increase on my family and my ability to afford utility service. But in order to really make the case upon which the commission can make a decision, and they take these things, I hope, in consideration what the public says, but you really need somebody to go in and say the utility company is asking for recovery of several $100 million for this plant that they're building, and as we look at it, some of these costs are not justified. Here's a place where they could have competitively bid and brought the cost down. Here's a place where this particular company is charging much more for this, and we know that this other company has been able to do it, you know, with a different piece of equipment or a different vendor and bring the cost down. So it's those kind of arguments where the commission is given an evidentiary record of what is exactly in the filing, and you need somebody with that level of expertise to be able to go through these filings and find these things to make those arguments.
Another issue that Andy Doro brought up in his column is that the Ohio Chamber of Commerce is concerned about mission creep, that the Ohio Consumers Council has become involved in issues outside the rate-making process. For example, he says the office was a vocal advocate in mandating that Ohio implement a renewable energy portfolio standard, and that actually went against the interests of Ohio ratepayers, Ohio consumers, because alternative forms of energy can be more expensive at this point in the game.
Well, again, this is something I would disagree with. The renewable energy piece was one piece in a large piece of legislation a couple of years ago that overhauled the electric deregulation system. And actually, OCC drafted the language that put the 3% cap in the cost of renewables being added into rates. So we found a way to balance both trying to develop the renewable energy industry, which the renewable energy folks wanted, along with having some sort of control over the cost. But really what you need to do we also supported very much energy efficiency, which is a least cost measure. When you're looking on a forward-looking basis, doing a 20-year plan for a utility company, which is typically what they look at as what is the growth in demand and what resources are they going to have to meet that, we think that renewable energy has a role to play, and it's a small role, but that role, it's not the most costly option. If you build a nuclear power plant or you build some of the traditional power plants, those can be more costly. And so this is just a very small piece, and we have a cap to make sure it doesn't cost too much, and we need to look at diversifying our portfolio for energy independence, for strengthening our economy. There have been a lot of jobs created from renewable energy, which has benefited Ohio. Ohio, especially in the Northwest, has become a hub for solar energy manufacturing and development. And those are all good things that have helped this state. And the impact on customers' bills, you know, looking at the analysis that we have gotten to date, has been de minimis. It's very small.
Of the 17 states with Consumers Council offices independent of the Utilities Commission, Ohio's is the largest, according to Andy Doral from the Ohio Chamber of Commerce. And he says even with the proposed cut, the 51% cut to the operation, Ohio's would remain in the top four in the country. He says you make a lot of money. You make more than the top office holders in the state, elected office holders, that you don't need the money, that you already are the biggest, and you'll still be one of the four biggest without it.
Well, I think that information is slightly incorrect. First of all, the California Advocate Office has a budget that's three times the size, roughly, of our agency, and that's left off the list. But I think the important thing to look at is how many cases do we have in Ohio compared with other cases? What is the size of the Office of Consumers Counsel as compared to the commission? If you look at it from that light, Ohio's Consumers Council, our budget is approximately 9% the size of the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio. You take a look at a state like Indiana, which has the highest percentage. The budget of the Indiana Advocate is 60% the size of their commission. We have a lot of cases.
It's a relativity issue.
Yes, then. Absolutely. And so you can pull any number out in a vacuum and say, whoa, this number looks big or this number looks small. But you really have to look at what do we do with that money and what we have done with that money. For example, in this last biennium, we have saved customers with a budget of $8.5 million. We have saved customers $55 million in direct savings, meaning but for OCC's intervention in the case, that money would not have been returned back to customers. It would have been $55 million more in rate increases. And in working in coalitions with other groups, which include local governments, AARP, low-income groups, industrial groups, and manufacturing groups, we have saved, where OCC is doing the lion's share of the work and doing most of the heavy lifting, we have saved customers in the last 2 years $1.9 billion. So I would say for that investment of $8.5 million, that's money well spent, and those are the numbers they should be looking at, is what are we doing with the money? What benefit are we bringing back to customers?
We invited AEP, American Electric Power, to join the show today, among many others. But let's just take them for example. They are endorsing the cuts to Ohio Consumers Council. When you likened yourself to a prosecutor and the Public Utilities Commission as a judge, what would be someone like AEP, what would their role be, and where do you stand economically compared to something like AEP?
Well, AEP would be the defendant in a proceeding bringing forth cases to increase rates. And I have to point out that AEP and every other utility, when they come in to file for rate increases, their resources and what they bring to bear in each case far exceeds anything that the Office of Consumers Counsel could ever bring to bear in these cases in terms of the money spent to do one of these cases. You know, on the one hand, I kind of feel like our best argument is also our biggest problem. Our best argument is with $8.5 million, we have saved close to $2 billion. Well, that's $2 billion that all of the utilities do not have in their pockets as a result of our advocacy.
Increases in utility rates. They're saying that the assessment increases utility rates. The assessment's about a buck a person.
It's $1 per household.
Per household. And that the more you spend, the more it costs ratepayers. That's what Andy Dorrell of the Ohio Chamber of Commerce wrote in his column.
Again, that's an incorrect statement because our budget is set by the General Assembly. And whatever that budget is, we work within that budget. And once that budget is determined, we make an assessment to the utility companies.
That comes second.
Yes, okay. And that is embedded in rates. So we're not part of the general revenue fund, which is an important point to make. Cutting our budget is not going to help our deficit. The money that we will not get to represent customers will go back to the utility companies at this point.
It won't go back. It doesn't go back to the state. In another instance, Andy Dorrell makes the point that the Consumers Council advocated for policies that encourage businesses to help utilities meet certain mandates by implementing energy savings and efficiency projects. But then the office protested efforts by businesses to meet the very same benchmarks it had supported. Do you know what he's talking about there?
Sure. Within our energy efficiency law, there's a provision that allows businesses to opt out of paying the surcharge for energy efficiency if they can demonstrate that they are doing energy efficiency on their own. And we had a problem early on with businesses trying to come in and say, these are the savings that we're getting that had nothing to do, that were non-compliant with the law. So we got involved in a few of those cases because these were the first cases out the gate, and we wanted to make sure that the law was properly implemented. You know, the important point here is we have energy efficiency benchmarks in place, and the purpose of those benchmarks is to reduce the overall demand for electricity, which then defers the need to build very expensive power plants.
Which increases the rate, the cost
Correct.
To consumers.
Correct. And so if those energy efficiency benchmarks, benchmarks are not being achieved properly, then we're not doing what the legislature set out to have accomplished through implementing those in the first place.
Andy Dorrell writes that even within your core mission, the Consumers Council seems to spend, resources ineffectively, that since 2006, the office has appealed 17 PUCO decisions to the Ohio Supreme Court. Two of those cases are still open, but of the remaining 15, the office has won only a partial decision in one case and lost the rest.
Again, that's incorrect. We have, since I've been the Consumers Counsel, we have appealed 24 cases. We have no more cases pending before the Supreme Court. Last one was decided a couple of weeks ago. Of those 24, we have had partial or full wins in eight of those cases, which is a very good record when appealing cases to the Supreme Court. It's very hard to get a decision overturned. And for instance, one of our appeals just a couple of weeks ago was on an AEP case in which the Supreme Court held that the PUCO erred by allowing the company to recover $850 million. That's 100 times the size of our budget in rate increases. And right now we have remands pending at the Public Utilities Commission, and we're trying to get a lot of that money back to customers of that, as much of
because
that $850
million. Because the Supreme Court didn't go the next step and say they have to return the money.
Well, the Supreme Court remands it. The normal procedure is for the court then to remand it to the PUCO for a determination. So if we hadn't appealed that case, customers, you know, would be continuing to pay much higher rates. So when we get into cases, we don't do it lightly. We do it, you know, if we think, number one, there's been a major violation of the law, and number two, there are consequences to customers in terms of higher rates than they should be paying. If you look at us over, you know, and since I've been Consumers Counsel, we've probably had somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 cases. To say we've appealed 24 of them is a very small number.
So you're looking at a cut from about $8.5 million or some. What's your budget now?
Our budget is currently $8.5 million, which is 8.5% less than it was when I originally started as Consumers Counsel. So we're already operating at a more efficient rate. And with that 8.5% cut, we've seen our caseload more than double, and we are achieving savings of $2 billion. So we're doing a lot more with less and getting great results. The results speak for themselves.
So what would consumers lose in the process of having your budget cut in half? Anything? Or can you continue to do this just with less?
No. I mean, there will be significant losses. Right now we're looking at if we get a 51% cut in our budget that we may have to withdraw from over 100 cases that we're currently in. We'll have to very selectively choose what cases we can do going forward. That's going to mean more rate increases. And an important point about that is when we are successful in reducing rates for customers, the benefit doesn't just flow back to residential customers who we represent, but those savings are shared by businesses and industry. So we feel we have a real important role to play in terms of job retention and economic development, because we're helping to keep rates down. When businesses look to locate in Ohio, one of the big factors they will look at is what are their energy costs, because that's a major driver for them. And if we can keep rates down, that helps bring business into the state. So everybody will lose by a budget cut. And further, we will not be able to provide a lot of the consumer education and other benefits that we provide to customers that are so vital.
There's also the call center that folks can call to complain or to get information. Would you be able to sustain that after the budget cuts?
Well, one of the amendments would require us to transfer all of our complaints over to the Public Utilities Commission. It is likely that we would be unable to maintain our call center and provide the services that we do. And we get letters all the time from constituents about how we have helped them. You know, we think that helping to keep a customer connected and avoid disconnection and working informally with the utilities is really helpful.
It looks like the Senate's going to kill the gag order, but if they don't, I hope you'll come back and talk about that.
I'd be happy to.
Thanks to Janine Migden Ostrander. She is our Ohio's Consumers Counsel. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.